Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I was making pasta and mozzarella in my apartment, and I was selling to a couple Italian restaurants at the time. They pay me cash, and I was like, if I got busted, like, how much time can you do for mozzarella, you know? I always equate things on that. I
mean, possession of mozzarella
what are you in for? Yeah, you know, I was like,
Today is a special day on Special Sauce because my friend and food soulmate Chris Biago is in the house.
Oh, my God. What a treat this is.
Chris is the author of the new cookbook, Pizza, Pasta, and Other Food I Like. To call Chris merely a pizza chef is like calling the late B.B. King a guitar player. He does own two Pizzeria Bancos in Phoenix, Arizona, and I am quoted on the back of the book. The road to pizza nirvana goes through Phoenix, and I have unequivocally said that Chris makes the best pizza in the world. He also owns my favorite sandwich shop of all time, Pana Bianco, and then Bar Bianco, where you can wait your turn to eat at the pizzeria, at the original pizzeria, over a glass of vino and some prosciutto and Parmigiano Reggiano. I have said I call Chris the Pizza Poet Laureate, and so welcome to Special Sauce, my Poet Laureate brother.
Oh, brother, this is beyond such a great thrill because, you know, many of the conversations through my struggle in this business was I was fortunate enough to talk to you about life, and somehow we get back to food. But I think the one beautiful thing about it is our circle, we start to fill it with like minds.
In the acknowledgement, you talk about your friends, which you define as the ones you choose, which I thought was really, really succinct, fascinating, and resonant for all of us.
I think that's quite the responsibility.
You
know, in blood being thicker than water, but I think there's there's something about the eternity of karma and the choices we make.
Yeah, for sure. So tell us about life at the Bianco family table growing up.
Which... Oh, my gosh. It was noisy, I can tell you that. We had two speeds, usually. The speeds were on or off. And the off usually was, as much as I like to wax poetic about things, if someone's kind enough to ask, most of it was growing up listening, you know, to banter, life, challenges, struggles, you know, the light bill, you know, whatever it was. And I think the table was a place to work things out. And I think it was somewhere that I realized that kind of getting back to the table, you know, like if we look at architecture in a way and we look at the 60s, you know, I think something happened in the early 60s. As much as I like mid-century architecture and I love it, I think there was something about it. And I do love minimalism. I do. But I also love utility, and I noticed something happened in the sturdiness of our dining tables, that they went from being less sturdy to uber minimal.
Right.
And well, we couldn't lean on them as heavily.
That's so interesting, and so it's actually a metaphor for, you know, how the culture has evolved.
Yeah, and I think it was the tables were smaller, and they were less used and patinaed and.
Right,
you know,
and they held less emotion and spirit.
They did, and you know, you couldn't carve your name in the corner and nobody would notice. But
people were very serious in your household.
Yeah,
about food.
It was. It was very. It was a serious. Like if my grandparents were over. Like he didn't mess around. You know, like both my grandparents were. Neither of them were funny, to be honest with you. You know, my dad is freaking hilarious. He's the funniest guy I know. But I think it came from, again, that juxtaposition of finding something that you needed. And I think that he found, maybe in his life, the humor, you know, being an artist and the struggle in it. And growing up a kid at 143rd Street and Willis Avenue in the Bronx, you know, during the Depression, or being born in 27, getting, you know, through post-Depression, World War II, life struggles, you know, why can't he be in the Union like my grandfather and, you know, you know, being construction. So I think, you know, humor was his way of dealing with it. And that was something he kindly passed on to me, is being able to have a laugh as good medicine.
But food was really important.
Yeah, food is, you know what? Food was really important as your breath, basically.
Yeah.
You know, you want a coffee? You know, like people came over. It's like there was always cake and coffee that ascended.
Right.
You know, from the, you know, the little cafeteria would come out, or, you know, the Mr. Coffee Pot would be on, or the percolator, which was one of my personal favorite, only came out for company. You know, that sound of percolating coffee going in the styrofoam, you know, company cups, along with the newfound bundt cake that was all the rage between the relatives, you know, brought a sense of comfort, if not perfection, you know.
And yet the food obviously meant comfort, but it also meant animated discussion.
Yeah.
It meant celebration. It meant, some cases, sadness.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I mean, you know, I'm born in 62. My consciousness of coming into, I guess, manhood, maybe when I was 8 or 9 years old, was meant by Vietnam, you know, on the heels of it, or would it ever end, or war, or life, or just post-assassination
right.
and change. And I think the world that I lived in did its best to homogenize that and maybe, I don't say cover it up.
But avoid it. Avoid painful
Like
topics.
No one really died, essentially, right. in the 70s.
Right.
It was just the Brady Bunch, which was eternal, which we turned on and they're the same age. But there was something that, you know, meant to find relief from that, or distraction,
right.
or both.
Sure, sure. But did you gravitate to cooking right away?
You know, it was funny. I was thinking about this most recently. I think what I really gravitated towards most about cooking was, since this is me and you here, and I can tell
yeah.
you, I think that I've been very, you know, insecure just in my existence, like where I fit in. I wanted mm-hmm. to make you happy.
Right.
Like I wanted you to like me, whoever that you were. And I noticed that my mom, who's, you know, it was her ability to provide something for you beyond sustenance. You know, you somehow ground it out through church and through, you made it through this reward of Sunday lunch and
right.
the gravy or the rigatoni or whatever that was there to await you that brought incredible pleasure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
to look at, you know, I would say if it's a tomato or a rumor, consider the source. And I think when you understand the source of that, or at least a link in that chain, was a human being, in this case, my mom.
Right.
I think it made me gravitate towards
that.
Towards that aspect of wanting
Interesting.
to please you. And so I think it wasn't as romantic of, you know, my father was a chef and I
right.
you know, studied at his knee. Or could it be a job? I didn't really understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew that, you know, and later on I was 13, I'm working at a pizzeria. But even all that stuff was to get wait till you get a real job and
right.
wait till you see what you're going to be when you grow up. And
right.
those are words we heard. But as I go forward now, I think about with my kids or even with young people, I think, you know, to want to empower them to be self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Self-sufficient emotionally.
Well, emotionally. I think that, and it's like everybody doesn't need to be a chef. And maybe everybody hopefully is more secure than I was. But I think if you understand that one single pound of artisan dry pasta and 1/28 count of great quality, you know, tomatoes, you can make exactly 4 portions, you know, of
sure.
pasta to feed your friends.
Right.
Or to impress the date that you've been, you know, try to get the courage to ask.
Right.
You are empowered to not be at the mercy
right.
of mediocre.
Right. Different things save different people. And you once told me that cooking saved you. You
no
said
doubt. Yeah.
most of my friends went one way, which turned out to be the wrong way, and I went another.
Well, I think that's funny you should ask it, you know, being here. And I think being able to put an addendum to that or even further mumbling through that, it wasn't the wrong way for them, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the whole thing. That's the whole. Because that might get the scorn of anybody I grew up with. It's like,
right.
oh, really, you're Mr. Right Way now. You know, Mr. The Other Way. You know, how's the view from that place? But I think it's more about, you know, it's kind of like why I left New York. It was like, it wasn't because I didn't love New York. You know, I mean, I love New York. I was born here. But I also felt, maybe my family being immigrants or from an immigrant background, I always felt a visitor. And I think that's what's beautiful about New York.
Right.
Shit, Statue of Liberty is a visitor.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's hanging, it's living here,
it's
but,
true.
You know.
You know, it's funny, I think about that all the time, because now I take the train across yeah. the Manhattan Bridge to get to the Studio Seats offices, and I still make sure that I'm in a seat on the subway car so I could look at the Statue of Liberty precisely because of that. Yeah. Especially now, given the political climate, it gives me hope.
I guess everything will set us free in our own ways. But for me, what set me free was, you know, my grandfather, you know, God bless them, they were all about, Chris, you got to own something, and you got to own something. And even though I respect that, you know, buy something, and you got to own it, and that's got to be yours, I think I'd rather rent for the rest of my life in a place I want to be in than own something in a place that compromises anything about that, my existence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the thing about cooking, too, which was I never would want to go cook in a place I didn't want to live. You know, there was no job that was important enough or no, you know, apprenticeship was important enough to be painful. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, I always say, I say for me a lot because it is only for me. I think even about this book, this will not be the last book you'll ever need. My, you know, thankfully you need plenty more. And, you know, maybe I'll even be able to scribble down another one to explain what I didn't get right the first time. But I think the factor that I always felt a visitor and we never really own anything. It's going to be, you know, whether my kids hopefully one day they won't fight about who owns what or, you know, I'm doing my best to give them some insight that, hey, man, this is for people that want to share in something that's positive. And one of my fears was, as I saw, like, even growing up in New York, like, crying when, you know, Matchbox cars that came from England in a little box, you know, they start disappearing or they change or look different. Or, you know, the candy store closed, you know, and you got the egg cream. And, you know, so you went through this life now waiting for the shoe to drop in so many places. Like, oh, wait till this guy does a place with 2,000 seats. Wait till this guy sells out. Wait till that guy. We're waiting for that moment instead of submitting to this moment.
Yeah. So you started making pizza at a pizzeria near your house, right?
Yep.
But then, sort of on a whim, you ended up in Phoenix.
Yeah, well, you know, the joke was I ran out of money before I got to California. That was the joke. But I think the truth, though, is why I stayed was there was a sense of I felt at home there. I think it was that simple.
And didn't you win, like, a—
No, you know, a buddy of mine, he bought two tickets. He bought a Mustang, and he got two tickets anywhere in the United States.
Ah.
And we were supposed to go to California. And my buddy's apartment in Laguna Beach that had nine other guys staying at their time and it didn't work out. So we ended up, I think I saw a commercial about the Phoenix Open. I wasn't a golfer, but there was something on, you know, one of the Sunday shows something about the Phoenix Open, and they showed all that orange trees and things and 60 degrees and sunny. I was like, damn. And then another buddy of mine that went to, like, truck driving school out there or mechanic school out there, you know, told me about it, and the next thing I know, we're in Phoenix, and
and then
I'm stealing bitter oranges from the trees.
You're
stealing. That's not a good word, but I was enjoying their.
And you're selling mozzarella and going door to door.
Yeah, well, kinda. It was like I you know, you do what you know, and I was making pasta and mozzarella in my apartment, and I was selling to a couple Italian restaurants at the time, and they pay me cash, and I was like, if I got busted, like, how much time can you do for mozzarella, you know? I always equate things on that. I
mean, possession of mozzarella intent to sell?
What are you in for? You know, I was like,
Possession of mozzarella with intent to sell probably is not going to get you 5 to 10.
No, you're not going to. I mean, nothing, no big deal. Maybe slap on the wrist, but, and then from there, I was fortunate enough. I was doing some catering, and I'd go to people's homes, and I'd bring my little pasta roller. I'd bring some unglazed baking towels, and I'd do, like, pizza at your house, or I'd make pasta as part of the, you know.
It was your home dinner theater.
It was my home dinner theater. It was my survival mode, which was, hey, I'd come cook for you, and, you know, I got a few people that didn't enjoy what I did, and there's one, a guy named Guy Coscas, a French guy that was super nice to me and kind, and he bought this old grocery store and repimped it to be the Euro Market, kind of like it.
I love it.
Yeah,
that he called it the Euro Market.
Oh man, come on, man! It was 87.
Right. It was the era of the Euro Market.
Yeah, it was it. I mean, it was pretty swanky, and at least 280 square feet in the corner. And that was where the first one started, in Pizzeria Bianco.
And you were literally making pizzas in the corner of the grocery store, and people would come on their way home. And...
Yeah, they come and they I'd put a ticket on their box and they take it up front and pay for it. And it was an interesting life, you know. Yeah. It was like, I thought that would be it.
I bet you were really happy.
I was extremely happy because, you know what? Somehow my life made up itself. Like, there was something that, like, looking for what I was going to be when I grew up, somehow the little bit of skill set that I was blessed to have allowed me just enough to pay my rent.
Right.
And have some beer money and gas money.
So. Doing something you kind of like.
Yeah, I kind of liked. And from there, I tell you, this is a weird thing. As much as I love architecture and you know, looking for junk and old antique store crap, all the crap that my mother made me do when I was a kid, like, I remember going to the 26th Street Flea Market back in the day when it was there. And on Sundays, I hated going. You dragged through all this crap that people could, you know, couldn't live without, you know, looking for frames like from my dad and like junk. You know, realizing years later, as I look for junk all over from my restaurants that I cherish, you know, it reminds me like to drag my kids through that similar pain. And then some days, maybe 40 years from now, they'll appreciate it.
Right.
So it reminds me not to ask kids what they want to do. You know, just
And
trust
then
me.
You went from there, you moved to Santa Fe.
I was a chef at a little restaurant called Babo Gonzo.
Okay.
The super cool restaurant was right across from me, kind of this beautiful mirage of perfection, which was... David Tanis was the chef.
A columnist at the Times.
Yeah, at Cafe Escalera. One of the finest palates on the face of the earth, I'll tell you right now. I mean, from that distance, you talk about perspective. I was literally, I don't know, 37 yards away from the front door of that restaurant. And it was the first time, like, I thought I had good technique and we did good pastas. And, we were doing some great things at the time. We had a wood-burning rotisserie, wood-burning oven, pastas, you know. But... across the way there, that was the first time as a young chef that I saw them. There was a huge Chez Panisse expat crew there, and seeing at 3 o'clock having family meal while the farmers come in, I was like, dude, this is where it's at.
Right, this is American pastoral.
This is it. This is this is the X factor, which is civil. Inviting civility.
Civilization is coming to cooking.
Yeah, exactly. We're all going to sit down and eat, sitting down, feeding ourselves, and this is going to be cool. And so that was able, they did this really cool thing that I told Deborah.
A seminal American chef, Deborah Madison.
Well, I saw her a week ago in Denver at Slow Food Event. And she did this incredible thing for all the, all the dregs of kitchen society. They would open up the bar in the morning just to do coffee, and she made this cornbread with this ladle of custard in it that she baked up. It was so next level, and it was this thing where people that would go through it was all about how many doubles did you pull a day or how many hours?
Right.
You bitch and moan about your current conditions or how you got
underpaid. It was an early morning hang.
It was, but there was this place where... it was like super cool. Like, there was always the most, beautiful, like, Mingus and jazz and like no words. And it was an incredible environment.
Yeah, that's
of
great.
Like a place where I felt where I wanted to ascend to.
Yeah. And
somehow and bring some of that back.
And you must have discovered that there was a community for you.
There was. There's a place for me. And I think that is going back to, first place, finding a place where you fit in, finding a place that it would accept you.
Yeah.
And finding a place where the relationship becomes mutual. Like we hear in our world by, let's just say, some politicians about winning. Winning for me was never about you losing.
Right.
It's like if the employer wins and the employee loses, that's a bad recipe.
Right.
But if we both, can find a way to as much as possible have a positive net gain.
Right. Yeah.
You
once said to me, at last, I had something to offer from my past, a reverence for what my family had.
Yeah.
I realized that what I had, what was in me, was something of value. That occurred in Santa Fe,
I think,
right?
I think it's there comes a You know, I try to do as much as I can with young people, you know, young chefs that, you know, they're searching for something. And what I challenge them to do is take everything out of their apartment, their spiritual apartment, and put it on their front lawn, and to see what they have they want to bring back in.
Mm-hmm.
And redecorate their life with, or their inspirations with. And
wow.
And sometimes they have much more than they understand.
Yeah,
like
sure.
They grew up on that pig farm in Iowa.
Right.
And, you know, the butchering techniques they had, they never appreciated, or the smoking in the South, or they grew up in Bulgaria, or the pick, whatever that they had.
Right.
It's seeing how we can, you know, implement their own self-worth.
Right. And that's what you learned firsthand.
I can only share that with them, because that's what, it wasn't in me. I discovered it from these other people.
Yeah.
And then it was just like, you know, finding your place and finding, I think we talked a little bit about, and this is not sucking up to you at any, you know, we talked real
right.
always, but I really always did about in the relationship aspect of, you know, later in the game of in that transparency and in that talking about food. Like, if we want the world to change how we're received, you know, being transparent and being in talking about food, its challenges, you know, life, what we fear, you know, all these little things would help. This is kind of pre-internet, you know,
right,
kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know, we have so much, you know, there's so much information, so many things, gratefully now. But, you know, before it was just like, could I find somebody to talk to about this?
Right.
And you
and
know
when
what?
You did.
And when you did, man, just let it flow. And
right.
then, you know, trust it. That, you know what, it is like, it's this will not be a good analogy, so I'll try it anyway. I was always amazed, you know, like, if you were a raving lunatic, that, you know, people would leave a knife out, that you could stab somebody, you could do something crazy. Like, the only thing holding us back from not doing something crazy is our own, you know, self-restraint, and it would make a mess, or maybe even really hurt somebody. But in that same... And that same thought, like giving, this is why I said it wasn't a good analogy, but the same thing of giving somebody about who you really were, about when you were afraid, or, you know, there's this one thing I wrote about the book about, I think it's Love and Masters, this thing about, you know, I always felt out of place in be able to master something. I think in a lot of places you can use that word
right.
and, you know, and I have no problem with it. But for me, personally, I felt that I never wanted to give, you know, like sometimes, you know, these kids will be doing something for a weekend, they get a certificate, they're a master, whatever, you fill in the blank. I felt there was a sense that I want to arm people with, that anything I ever did could fuck me anytime it wants if I disrespected it.
Right.
Whether it was I took my eye off the ball in any way, the dough was equally as great as I was, or the way I leavened it, or the temperature of the fire, or, you know, I mishandled, you know, I put the basil near the blower in the cooler and turned black because it froze. Whatever it was, I felt that, you know, this was an equal partnership at best.
You know, I remember something you once said to me about pizza. You know, you said, I have invented nothing. I'm just trying to do something, one small thing right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on a mission. I have a responsibility to do something with integrity and dignity. My menu might be small, but to me, it's the biggest thing in the world. Pizza inspires me, fascinates me, and gives me hope.
Yeah, yeah, that's, I feel that way today still.
And that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was, but I would say some things, thankfully, I've evolved in the way I see the world or the way I see myself, but that's something that rings true. I think what fascinates me about it, because I would go deeper into that. You know, pizza in itself is never that important, but pizza as
a metaphor.
As a metaphor for the people, the struggle, you know, its place is something we can count on, something that we can share, something we can relate to. You know, someone was asking me today, like, what's the best pizza? And, you know, like, for me, I come back to New York for different things. And one of them is really just to receive what it's willing to give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of those was, you know, there's two parts to it, I think. It's one is, if we want to get super geeky about what are the best ingredients and the best menu, or something that is that flickering, you know, neon light and getting a slice in a window. You know, the dog that you had to have growing up that's from this guy or this place.
Right.
You know, I would never want to deny anyone's greatness for that. And I think
yeah.
that's a two part of great.
Mm-hmm. I agree
you know,
with you.
And I think later on, it's like, understand tasting good is one thing, and it's really important when it serves. But when we really want to talk about something's greatness, I think that is a conversation. To do something truly great can only, something that only tastes great can only start for me, I'd say, with things that are already fucking perfect
right.
and great and
like,
optimum.
Like the ingredients.
And uncompromising, yeah. like the ingredients. That's the rub there, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you
does that make sense at
yeah,
all?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
you'll edit all this out.
No,
you'll make me look smart.
No, but you once said to again, there's no mystery to my pizza: Sicilian oregano, organic
yeah.
flour,
yeah.
tomatoes, purified water, mozzarella. I learned to make at Mike's Deli in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Sea salt, fresh yeast cake, and a little bit of yesterday's dough.
Yeah.
In the end, great pizza, like everything else, is all about balance. It's that simple. And the book is sort of a reflection of that. One of the things that I like about the book is that it's a book of empowerment, you know, which must have been a very conscious decision on your part. And you weren't trying to hit people over the head with how complicated things were.
Yeah.
In fact, it was just the opposite. You've always been all about reducing things to its essence, to their emotional essence, to their spiritual essence, to their flavor essence. You know, that's always been part of who you are.
It's a little bit like being a you say you want to do a restaurant, you want to open a restaurant. I think own it to yourself, the community, your fellow chefs in the community, all parties involved, the farmers, can they supply you? You look at what does that community need, you know, not what you want to give it.
Right.
So I think ultimately I decided to a book. I said, well, there's so many great books about bread and about dough. Jim Leahy's book's fantastic. I love him. Chad's book of tartines, fantastic. I love it.
Chad Robertson.
Yeah, Chad Robertson, the tartine. I love him like a brother and, you know, great. Mark Vetri, his book on pasta.
From Philly,
and love him. And his new book on pizza will be fantastic. The kid, Joe Badia, has got a book, Pizza Camp. I think it's really cool. And,
that's the guy in Philly,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Philly, too. I mean, great. I mean, and many others that have incredible perspective on those things. All I wanted to try to do in your arsenal of attacking anything flat or round or... other shapes that are in the book, you know, desserts and things too. But giving you that really the same approach to I know for me, hey, it's not I'm proud of, but I left school after 10th grade and went to work because I had trouble, you know, understanding.
Right.
You know, what was being presented to me, not because school wasn't great or teachers weren't great, but it was me. It's kind of like it's me, not you kind of thing.
Right.
So what I wanted to do maybe was talk to people the way I find a language that I was capable to understand because all the other books that I just mentioned and beyond will help you and they are necessary and our books should be full as our life should be full with perspective. But I hope that you can use something that will arm you with an aha moment of empowerment because when I started especially, there was about 2 out of 3 restaurants closed. This, you know, as you think you got, you know how many pizzerias there are in the world, you know how many people might pop, whatever it was, you know, the tomatoes or, you know, whatever business that I was a part of, I just studied it and just said, hey, I'm going to bring something
yeah.
sincere to the big picture and serve something that I'm capable.
Yeah. And so it's so interesting. You opened Pizzeria Bianco in
88, first yeah. one, and then a sit-down in 94, yeah.
Right. Did you have any idea that so many people in the food world would take what you were doing so seriously?
No way. Not even close.
Because nobody was doing it then.
Yeah. You know what? I think the one thing was they weren't necessarily doing it with pizza, but like, you know, Zuni and Alice and when... you know, Acme Bread opened up or,
right.
you
all,
know.
All in the Bay
yeah,
Area.
Yeah, all in the Bay Area, mostly. But, I mean, I remember, you know, even here, you know, Montrachet.
Right.
Definitely, you know, for me, even different genre of food, but inspiring and important restaurant.
Right.
I never really thought about
You'd
pizza.
You never thought that it was merely pizza.
Yeah, that's probably my ignorance or my my delusion. I never saw it as what anyone else saw it as. I saw it as something that, I'm always, and I still am intrigued by, I'm fascinated that I can give you a pile of paper, not you know, and you'll give me that cool chair.
Right.
You know? It's tangible. There's no, I can sit in it.
Right.
I can see it, and I can appreciate it. I know it came from a tree.
Right.
But you as man has gave this currency, this paper.
Right.
A sense of worth.
And you felt that way about...
And I felt that way about foie gras.
Right.
Why is it better than fucking chicken livers?
And you felt that way about the ingredients of a pizza.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing, no disrespect against foie gras, I dig it all. But I'm saying, or caviar, the people were probably throwing away. I said, maybe we should save those eggs.
Right.
Ah, pretty good. You know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
So it's just, we are the ones that give cut glass or diamonds their worth.
Meaning and context.
Meaning and context. So for us, I always try to say, well, fuck, man, what do you dig? How thick should your pizza be?
Right.
You're like, you know, when? How long should you cook a pizza? Until it's done for you.
Right.
You know, so I'm saying is when you look at an oven, or I remember when Jeffrey Steingarten came out. And
you know why Jeffrey Steingarten?
Because you sent him.
I know you did.
Because
when I was writing my pizza book.
He was a non-believer.
Book, yeah, he was like, I said, you know, Jeffrey, the best pizza in the world, at least according to my explorations, is in Phoenix. And he literally was like, you're full of shit.
Yeah.
You know, so I said, go.
Yeah.
You know, and so then he was doing an article on pizza, and he called me, by the way, from Phoenix after he had your pizza. And you know, Jeffrey, he's not given to, you know.
Yeah, he was.
Right, and he said, you were right, and that's all. And then he hung up the phone.
Well, you know, but I think the one thing was, like, you know, he came out, he just got back from Naples, and he had the ray gun with the temperature telling you how hot the oven is. And I was just saying, like, I don't even want to know how hot it is.
Right.
Like, I don't care. There isn't a formula. It's like, because I knew inside the fire was really hot, but if I kept away from it, it'd be less. So I'm saying is like that even in the book is forget anything except what is actually happening in the moment. Like, had a great pizza got been making in El Forno in Rhode Island. Well, maybe they didn't have a wood burning oven, but they had this cool hot grill, and shit, that good dough on hot grill makes sense.
Yeah, yeah,
it's of worth.
Yeah.
So I think there, for me, like if I went to Naples, and I love Naples and I love the pizza there, but I think to empower you with, you know, if you were going to a place that loved well done steak,
right,
you would not. I would not come away and say, hey man, you know, that's the worst way to cook. You, that could be my opinion.
Right.
I could feel that way.
Right.
But I'm here to deny a preference.
Right. Because you're not, you've never been a slave to rules.
No.
You know, there was the VPN.
Yeah,
the...
no, but I think it's, I have incredible respect of it.
Right.
But I also understand about Naples, the minute you leave Naples, it becomes an homage to it.
Right.
So why wouldn't, maybe for me, give respect to it and respect the people that do it and love it and want to build whatever that they want to that.
Sure.
The greatest thing that I could do is hybrid my existence in New York growing up, the hybrid of New York pizza, of Italian pizza, and then what was going on the West Coast at the time.
Right, and what was going on in your head.
Yeah, and what was going on in my head. So I think those things, me knowing I never invented anything.
Right.
And know if you followed the paper trail, or in this case, the breadcrumb trail, you know, you'd find that there was a lot to do with all of it that deserves much credit.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and you know, at the end of the day, you know, what drove, I mean, as I watched Naples, this is my opinion, but when you say, okay, you know, 90-second bake is the perfect time for pizza, and maybe it is, but maybe it also started because, you know, your Vespa's triple parked in Naples, and you ain't waiting anymore, and that's valid.
And you're gonna get a ticket.
And that's valid.
Right.
And that's
for sure.
You know, but how long would it take if it could take as long as it needed?
Right.
That's
funny.
You know, that's the thing. And, you know, maybe it still is 90 seconds at the end of the day.
Well, it worked, right? Because you were like
so
the,
far,
first,
so
the,
far.
The first and only pizzaiolo that's ever won the James Beard Award, which is incredibly cool.
That was very nice.
Chris, we haven't even delved very heavily into the book, which is awesome, and what eventually forced you away from the oven and your amazing, beautiful family.
They are. So, even like, on, even on radio, back? They're beautiful. I would love to come back at no place I'd rather be.
And we'll see you then, Serious Eaters.